We're opening up the House Committee on Human Services today, Friday, March 20th, 2009. We're moving along. We're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2883.
This bill creates a public task force of at least 11 members for the purpose of studying public guardian and conservator services in Oregon, including the need for services, models, efficiency, funding, and legislative requirements to make those services possible. It directs the task force to prepare recommendations and provide a cost assessment for implementation of their recommendations. It establishes the Public Guardian and Conservator Task Force Fund and permits the task force to employ staff, accept contributions from public or private sources, and declares an emergency. You have an amendment before you that would allow the task force to accept donations, but does not allow the task force to be funded through general fund monies and allows the reversion of monies to the general fund when the task force disbands.
Great. Thank you, Keely. So we will call up Bob Zundef, Mary Guerra, and Jeffrey Surprise! Representative Cowan, tell us.
Madam Chair, if I might direct the order in which you have folks up here.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair and fellow members of this committee. Because my name is on this one, it seemed like it was probably important for me to let you know that I brought this forward at the request of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services as a result, and I'm a member of that group as well. They have done a great deal of work in visiting various entities around the state and talking about issues that relate to seniors and people with disabilities, and this is an issue that just sort of keeps popping up as those conversations take place. And the individuals that have been involved with this have done a great deal of work in pulling this together. The names that you had read off are people who have been very much involved in it and you will need to hear from, but I think I might respectfully suggest that you open with Bob Lawrence, who brings this to you from the Governor's Commission on Senior Services.
I would be delighted to do that.
Would you like to entertain questions?
I
would be happy to, but I'd rather you set the questions to those who know a lot more about this than I do.
We will certainly do that. Thank you so much, Representative Cowan. So, Bob Lawrence, come on up.
Good morning. Representative Tomei is a member of the committees, and thank you, Representative Cowan. I didn't prepare anything, but I want to just mention that all of the work that has gone into this bill. Representative Richardson did have a bill in 07 that required public guardianship and conservatorship programs. However, he had a steep money, general funds of $2 million. The counties are not reluctant to set up public guardianship programs, but they are expensive, and there's not much of a return on them. So they're very reluctant to do that. There is a statute that you will hear about later, ORS 125, I believe. And so we have taken this on. This developed out of a result of the Elder Abuse Coalition Task Force that the Governor's Commission has been meeting with for years with the Justice Department. A member of Mary Gear's staff, Judy Gigi, set up four meetings to talk about this issue, and the first meeting was 45 people, so there's widespread need across the state. In every municipality, the Governor's Commission visited 17 cities in the last 4 years. Everywhere we visited, we said that we heard from prosecutors, we heard from local lawyers, law enforcement, protective service workers, if we only had a public guardianship program that would stabilize the financial situation so we could deal with the other social problems. So we've taken this on. It's been 2.5 years of planning. We have it before you. We have a wonderful partnership in the private sector, and we want to recommend to the committee that this may be the future, a combination of private and public engagement as the public money start to draw up, and they're going to continue to go away. So I will turn this over to our expert panels that can discuss those questions, and appreciate all the help of Representative Cowan, who's on our commission, and Senator Morissette, who's also on our commission, because they, when we first started with this, they both said, don't ask for money or it's dead. So we went and found money.
Great.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Thank you so much, Bob.
Thank you.
Thank you for all the work you've done. So now back to my panel. Bob Junedef, Mary Gehr, and Jeffrey Brandon. And some of the people here know that I have given a time certain to Representative Kotek, who is presenting a bill today at 9 o'clock because her schedule is very tight. So if we may take a brief recess from this bill in order to talk about her legislation, but we'll come back to it. So thank you so much. So whomever goes first, please do it.
I think Mary's
going to go first. Mary. Chair Tomei and members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Mary Gehr. I'm the administrator for the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care in the Department of Human Services Seniors and People with Disabilities Division. I'm very pleased to be able to be here this morning to testify on House Bill 2883. As Mr. Johnson mentioned, my staff were continuously seeing this issue pop up, as Representative Cowan said, and pulled together a very interested group of folks last fall. And we were thrilled with the response and turnout and leadership that's come out of that group to get to this point, and really want to thank the stakeholders and GCSS for their leadership on the bill. The department supports the idea of a task force to look at the necessity for and what a model might look like for a public guardian and conservator program. Funding for this bill is not in the governor's recommended budget, and so absent any fiscal impact, we'd like to certainly support the bill. The issue that Adult Protective Services sees on a regular basis, and these are the specialists in the field who respond to the emergency calls that we get for folks who vulnerable people who are at risk, what they see is people who are at risk, who have needs, who may not be able to assess those needs, and in many cases we're able to find a family member or a friend or an interested party who can step up and act as a power of attorney or guardian in those kinds of situations where it's necessary. Where this really comes into play is when a person has neither the financial resources or the social resources to be able to have that happen. And those are probably the most difficult situations for our protective services specialists to have to deal with. There's always the balance of an individual's civil rights, and any time that we're looking at limiting or restricting or removing those rights, it's a difficult balance, so we go through the legal system for that. And so those are the kinds of questions that a task force will need to look at, is how do we make sure that people are protected and have the resources they need, but also ensure that people's rights are protected and that the legal system is used to the best of its ability to protect all facets of an individual. So as I say, we absolutely support the idea of a task force, and would be happy to have participation on that task force. Staffing the task force is probably not something that we're able to do fiscally, but do want to be supportive of the efforts as we move forward. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mary. I think we're going to hear from the whole panel, and then we'll open up to questions.
Okay. Representative Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Brandon. I'm a member of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services and here to speak in support of House Bill 2883. I want to say a few words about my background. I got a law degree in the mid-70s and didn't want to be a lawyer. So I was lucky to get a job with a little-known program in Multnomah County called the Public Guardian and Conservator, which I hardly knew what that was about myself. But I studied up, and I got the job. And then 25 years later, I finally retired in 03 after doing that job for 25 years. So that's what I've been for most of my professional career, as a deputy public guardian and conservator for Multnomah County. When I retired, I was lucky to get on the commission, and then I always had this nagging feeling that something was really amiss in this state, and that we had a really good program in Multnomah County, and another program in Jackson that was really having funding problems, but they were surviving, and nothing else in the rest of the state. And so my project upon retirement is basically this, is to get something going in the rest of the state in the area of public guardianship. I wanted to clarify what a public guardian conservator does. Okay, real quickly. Basically, I have a hypothetical. So, if you had an Uncle Fred, and he was 82 years old, and he lived in a trailer park, and you knew he was getting dementia, and that his trailer was kind of falling down around him, and you might eventually get a call from Adult Protective Services saying, Uncle Fred is not doing well in his physical mental state, and his assets seem to be in disarray. He's not paying his bills. Why don't you do something? You're the only relative we can find, and so you might talk to that protective service worker, and having ruled out everything else, joint payeeship, trusts, advanced directives, any other ways of having a substitute legal help for Uncle Fred, you might have to retain an attorney, and you become Uncle Fred's guardian and or conservator. If you were his guardian, you would you're in charge of his physical person. You would make all decisions around his physical person, including medical, obviously. And if you were his conservator, you would handle his assets, whatever that is. You would be in charge of all of his assets. And so that's what a private guardian conservator would do. And now here's the point I want to make. If Uncle Fred has assets, you or a private fiduciary would probably take that case, because you can pay an attorney, and you can get paid yourself for being a guardian or a conservator of someone, a reasonable fee. But here's the key point. If Uncle Fred doesn't have assets, or he's been ripped off, scammed, he's lost his assets from one reason or another, then Adult Protective Services is really in a quandary, because who's going to take this case? Who's going to do this? If you're a relative and you did it just out of, because you're a relative, fine. But there's not too many cases like that. And so, again, Uncle Fred case, if you're in Multnomah County, you could go to the public guardian conservator, and they might take this case. And but if you're in other counties, Adult Protective Services just has to go searching for somebody. It's a very difficult situation to find a guardian conservator for a person that doesn't have assets. And so that's the situation we have. I wanted to say something about the existing statute, 125-700. It was passed in 1971 by the legislature, and it's an enabling statute. It says each county in Oregon may establish a public guardian and conservator. Multnomah County did in 1972, pursuant to the 71 legislature, and they funded it with a general fund. And here now, four decades later, it's still in existence, and I read the papers, and I haven't seen it on the cut list for Multnomah County. So it's an integral part of the system, and the Adult Protective Service system in Multnomah County to this day. Several attempts have been made over the past four decades for various counties in Oregon to get a public guardian conservator office pursuant to the statute. And only Jackson squeezed one through, And the rest, substantive efforts in Washington, Clackamas, Lane, various other counties, and you just cannot get this kind of program passed a county commission. You will hear from various other people testifying today, but there is a huge need out there for guardianship for Medicaid people, low asset people, and people who have been abused and their assets have been stolen from them. So the numbers, we don't have all the numbers, but it's in the thousands. And note that the range of disabilities that a public guardian can serves is not just seniors. It's any adult 18 and over who fits the legal definition of incapacity. So I'll just conclude. What will this task force do? There's four or five things. Okay, one thing it will do is examine the extent of the need in Oregon for this service. Number two, it'll examine what system do we have in Oregon. In other counties, like Clackamas County, the senior council is the guardian. It's not a public guardian, but it's a nonprofit, and there's a lot of small nonprofits. We need to look at all those. Number three, we need to find out exactly why counties won't pass a public. Number four, we need to address the need, because the need is massive. And, you know, it's possible that maybe it's not even a public guardian program. Maybe there's some other way to go about this. For instance, this is just a minor point, but in the state of Washington, the Medicaid program pays private guardians $75 a month to be the guardian for Medicaid people. So, you know, that takes care of some of the problem in Washington. This would be a two-year study. We're hoping to work with Bob and Disability Rights Oregon. So my concluding thing is that after four decades of this issue going on in Oregon, we need a breakthrough. This task force can be that breakthrough, and I hope we have your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Bob?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junduff. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon. I'm very pleased to be here today to speak in support of House Bill 2883, particularly as amended amendments, which will assure that this bill is fiscally neutral. Disability Rights Oregon has for many, many years been involved in the guardianship process in Oregon, regularly acting on behalf of people who either have guardians or for whom guardianship has been proposed, who may not be happy with that situation, may not be happy with their guardian or about having a guardian. And we will represent folks in court or in negotiations trying to work out problems in a guardianship situation. We also address situations in which there's a need for a person to have a guardian, and that because that person is being subject to abuse or neglect or financial exploitation, is unable to care for themselves and is clearly unable to make decisions for themselves. And so we have worked with other agencies in order to secure or allow the process to go forward to obtain a guardian. And there are organizations, very few in this state, that whose job it is either as a private entity or a governmental entity to provide guardianship services. We really do need more resources in this area, and we're very concerned that in going through the process of determining who needs that service when it's absolutely necessary, that this be done properly. What I provided you in writing is a handbook that we have that we distribute through our organization. It's available on our website, which is disabilityrightsoregon.org. Along with other materials that we provide. But this gives you sort of a primer, if you will, of how guardianship works. And I think it's just valuable to note that guardianship is really a private process. It's not a governmental process. And it exists so that a private individual can go to court and to suggest that a person does not have the ability themselves as an adult to make decisions that an adult normally is entitled to make. And because of that, that authority should be given to someone else, someone called a guardian or a conservator. And there are certain standards that must be proven in order for a court to do that. It's a very profound process because it shifts not all of a person's rights, but the right of a person to decide where they live, the right of a person to make their own medical decisions, perhaps the right of a person to make their own financial decisions, shifts those rights over to someone else. And once that happens, it is a quasi-permanent situation. And what I mean by that is that it will continue to be that way for the rest of that person's life, unless that person goes back to court and is able to demonstrate that they, in fact, now do have the capacity to make those decisions for themselves. So it's very significant. It's also important to note that state government does not provide any money for that process, and it's an expensive process. It normally requires a lawyer, and there's a judge, and there's a court visitor, and there's a bunch of costs associated with that. It can be thousands of dollars to go through that process. State law does not provide funding for attorneys for individuals who have been suggested to have a guardian, and they're called protected persons and under our law. So really, this is not a governmental process. Government doesn't fund it. Government doesn't fund lawyers for it, but it is does have profound effects upon a person's rights. All of that having been said, it may be absolutely vital to have an alternate decision maker for somebody who's vulnerable. So it's a bit complicated. It's in our view, very significant because it can profoundly affect a person's rights. And so it's important that we think very carefully about how we go about instituting a public system that puts in place the availability of guardianship services for those who really need them. And again, the people who really need them are people who don't have the money to go through, to pay the lawyer, to go through the process and do all the things that are necessary to do. And there's a very definitely a need for people who don't have those resources. So we're proud to have been thought of as a place to have the group come together, and we wanted to provide the supports that this task force would need in order to do some good thinking about this, some good study, and come up with some good recommendations.
Thank you, Bob. Any questions on this panel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe it's for Jeff, because you brought it up about the counties not doing the guardianship. Is it because of liability, or do you know? Is that?
Well, I think it's mostly about counties don't like to take on new social programs, period. You know, I mean, that seems to be the main thing. But you did touch on a good point. I mean, I'm not going to hide this point that the entity appointed in Multnomah County is the Multnomah County Public Guardian and Conservator. It's not an individual person. It's the entity. And therefore, Multnomah County does, yes, take on this. That's probably a very profound point.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jeff, question for you. In your testimony, and I'm also looking at the written testimony you provided, you mentioned it's a goal in a 2-year study to develop to give recommendations anyways to the legislation after that. I was going to suggest that I think I would most definitely do that a lot sooner than 2 years, but I'm looking at the bill itself and it appears it's just a year that you'd formulate in September, and then you would actually provide recommendations to the interim, to this committee, next October in 2010. So it'd be, so apparently you're okay with the year, how I feel.
Representative Tomei, Representative Olson, I'll have to read that closely again, because I think that's just an option, that interim, because I think it's also in there that at the beginning of the 2011 session that we make the full report, and that's actually, you know, less than 2 years, and this is a massive project. I'm worried about even 2 years to do this.
Madam Chair. Representative Cohen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The legislation as written does direct the group to come back to the Interim Committee of the Legislative Assembly no later than October 1, 2010. And I would suspect that the reasoning there in that verbiage is that in preparation for anything that might be addressed in the 2011 session, you would very much have to be bringing at least an interim report back to whatever the appropriate committee, likely this one, by October of 2010. Now, it's possible, I would assume, that that report could say, and we're still working on it, and we'll be back in another couple of years.
Yeah.
But I think that's an important point to clarify.
Yeah.
That whatever interim legislative body would be involved with hearing this would need a report by fall of 2010 in order to reasonably consider any kind of legislation.
Right. Good point. Thank you.
Session.
Thank you, Representative Cowan. Representative Olson, did you?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I was just going to say, and I agree with what Jeff's saying, I can see this probably being an ongoing adventure, really.
Right.
Thank you so much for coming to testify today. Now we have Meredith Coates, Mark Williams, and Margaret Carley. I'm sorry, Representative, I didn't see Representative Kotek come in. So can I hold this panel off until...
wait until you're ready for us.
Well, it'll be a while. So can you...
I can wait. If you want to keep going, it's fine.
Okay. You're sure?
Yes.
All right. Great. How much time will you need, Representative? How much time will you need?
We have a few folks before 3384, but I have to talk to Legislative Council beforehand. And wait till you want to wait for me. You haven't heard the bill yet at all.
No, we haven't heard the bill at all. I want to save enough time for you by the time we have to end at 10. So I'm just wondering. Half hour. Okay, so we'll fit in this at 9:30. Thank you, Representative. Okay. Great. Thank you so much for coming this morning.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Meredith Cote, and I direct the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. And we are delighted to be here today and strongly support House Bill 2883. Identifying, investigating, and resolving complaints is one of the primary functions of the Ombudsman program. And interestingly, the Federal Older Americans Act specifically identify complaints related to the welfare and rights of residents with respect to the activities of guardians. So as a result of that, we have responded, probably particularly since about the mid-90s, to hundreds of complaints related to guardians and guardianship services. As a result of the activities, we have become knowledgeable about how guardians work in Oregon, and we have been called upon in all sorts of situations to intervene with the court, to participate in proceedings on behalf of the protected persons in court, and so we've gotten a pretty good insight about all of the various ways that guardianship works throughout the state. And as a result of all of that, as you might imagine, we have some opinions about the need for accountability in guardianship, in a guardianship system, and the need for oversight in a guardianship system. But one of the things that we also know from our work is that it shouldn't matter, although guardianship is an option of last resort, it shouldn't matter in terms of your access, whether you have funding or have a family member or a friend who's willing to come forward and provide those services. Unfortunately, when there's a need for a decision maker to keep somebody out of harm's way or to get them out of harm's way, income should not be the barrier. These are some of our most vulnerable citizens. And so I look at House Bill 2883 as a very modest endeavor, and what it really says is that we've got to recognize that we have a population that is aging rapidly. We have people with disabilities who are also aging, and we've got to start looking at and examining the ways that we're going to adequately protect those people when they have a need. And so the reason that our agency is involved in this issue is twofold. One, we see that there is a need, and it just from an equitable standpoint, people who don't have income should have access. But the other part of it is that we also understand that any guardianship system has to be well considered. There have to be adequate protections for people for whom there are guardianships, and that we really have to do due diligence and not rely on some kind of ad hoc experiment everywhere, but really come to some consensus about how we want to proceed for something that is as serious as guardianship. And so that's why we support House Bill 2883, is because we believe it's long overdue, and it's really a modest first step in trying to get us to a place where we really need to be.
Thank you so much.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Mark Williams. I'm here to support HB 2883 and the Dash 1 amendment. I'm here in my capacity as an elder law attorney, and you may be aware that elder law is a specialty that's grown up in the law really over the last 25 years, and it's been my privilege to be involved in it kind of from the beginning as a private practitioner, elder law being kind of a catch-all for the area of practice in estate planning that used to specialize, when I was in law school, the only kind of glitzy specialization in estate planning would be taxation issues. It turns out only 2% of us have taxable estates, so putting all our energy into that was kind of an interesting endeavor, but not for me. What I wanted to do was make a difference for the other 98%. The situation that I see come up a lot in my practice is that someone is in long-term care, and they've got, they're middle class. They've got $200,000 or $300,000 in savings. They're in long-term care for a long time. They spend that money. And at the end of their life, they're left without assets. That's how they get on the Medicaid program, which is the safety net that the state has that pays for their care, and that's great. But on the other pole, we have the decision-making and surrogate decision-making process that elder law practitioners have come to specialize in. And as Jeff Brandon talked about, we don't necessarily have the situation in the hypothetical where Uncle Fred has a family member or someone who can step in for them. And if there's no money, it's amazing how it follows that there's no one who particularly cares to step in and serve in that role, take on that liability personally in that advocacy function. That's where the need for public guardianship comes in. I practiced in Portland for 25 years and moved back to my native Lane County a couple of years ago. And I was frankly stunned to find out that what existed in Multnomah County and exists in the makeshift ad hoc process that we've got in other urban counties, Washington County, Clackamas County, really didn't exist at all in Lane County or other rural counties around Lane County, that there's just it's a huge gap that needs to be filled in some way that makes sense. Attorneys in private practice do step up and do some pro bono work, and that's a great thing, but it's an ad hoc solution to a problem that is very grave, as we've talked about. a couple of the points that I would just reiterate that have been made today, that the guardianship really is a last resort kind of program. The statute says that a judge has to make a determination that this is the least restrictive alternative that we can come up with. So guardianship's not the first answer, it's the last answer. And if we get to a situation where it's serious enough that the court has to make the determination that we're going to avail ourselves of the last answer, we've got to also have someone who could step up and fulfill that promise. And so that's what we're really trying to figure out a way to do with this task force. And if the committee can support the creation of that task force, that's what we need to have happen. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good morning, Representative Tomey. My name is Margaret Carley. I retired in June of 2007 as the Deputy Director and Legal Counsel for Oregon Healthcare Association, which is a trade association of nursing homes, assisted living, residential care, and in-home care. I now work as an independent consultant and did work for the Department of Human Services, SPD. And I attended the public guardian work group that a number of us participated in, both as a participant and as a consultant to the department. As you heard, the task force or the work group, as we met, had broad representation from key stakeholders. The meetings ranged anywhere from 25 to 45, included members of the judiciary and several departments and state agencies, as well as elder law attorneys, advocates, and disabilities rights personnel. As I was driving down the road, I tried to figure out what question did my testimony answer. And the question is, like Jeopardy, why do we need a task force? Why couldn't this work group, with all of the brain power that was there, come up with what we needed and propose it to the legislature? The reason is the devil is really in the detail. What kind of training should fiduciaries have? How can a program be set up? Is there one model? Is there several models? How do you finance those models? And although we could agree upon principles and practices, putting detail into the types of programs, the options, and looking at the various models was not something that the group had the ability to do. And that's really why we need a task force, to look at this issue and to come up with details that then people can negotiate in terms of rights of protected persons versus roles of the courts and other things. So we really needed a group that can study the issue in depth and come up with some recommendations. We did look at a bill last session. Actually, this task force, with the help of the Governor's Commission, created this piece of legislation, which would give those five responsibilities to this task force and have them come up with recommendations for you. We also considered a version of a Washington bill. They passed a big change in their public guardian program, and that was Senate Bill 5320. But again, we have lots of details in that bill about how that program would be managed, and we weren't sure that that necessarily follow the way we wanted to do it in Oregon. In Oregon, one of the principles we agreed on is that we wanted people to have access in all of the parts of the state, and regardless of whether their income, to this types of services if they need it. I wanted to let you know that SPD staff has assembled a comprehensive folder all about public guardianship programs, including a grid of both state and other nations' programs and the appropriate citations. So there are tons of materials that we have assembled that could be used to jumpstart the work of this committee. It's not as if they have to start from ground zero. There's lots of materials currently available. There are different state models that are out there. In 2007, the Senate Special Committee on Aging completed a minority report entitled Guardianship for the Elderly, Protecting the Rights and Welfare of Seniors with Reduced Capacity. Senator Gordon Smith was one of the authors of this report. It examines a lot of the issues surrounding guardianship, describes recent efforts at improving it, summarizes proposals for change, and offers recommendations. Again, this could be used by a task force to streamline their work. We also had a conference call with the staff of the Senate Aging Committee, and they really recommended that we explore a collaborative, like you see, a private-public partnership where we could look at these issues, and also that it's a multi-agency issue. Recently, the Supreme Court Task Force on Protective Proceedings issued a report after a two-year study and recommended a public guardian program. The authors were the Honorable Rita Cobb and Honorable Elizabeth Welch, in that they provide some statistics about the percentage of the population that's going to be over 50, that seniors will outnumber their children, and that there has been an exponential increase in serious issues with the protection of incapacitated adults who are no longer able to care for themselves and their financial affairs. And they believe that what we really need is a public guardian program. And they indicated that this was currently being explored by the Department of Human Services, but this is something that the court also thinks there's a need for. So in summary, the role of a broader and better funded public guardian program should be studied, and that they will make recommendations to you all in the interim. There is statewide interest in improving this program, given the aging of the population, the prevalence of dementia, the other disabilities, and related cognitive declines. And we ask that you pass House Bill 2883. I'll get all my numbers right. As amended with the dash one amendments. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions of this panel? Thank you so much for bringing this material to us. It's very important for us to learn about this and appreciate all the work you've put into this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now we have Marcy Ingledew, am I anywhere close? Patty Little Lane and Travis Wall. I don't know, like that.
Travis, do you want me to go?
Hi, sir.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Marcy Ingledew, and I'm wearing two hats today. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Disabilities Commission, that I'm an appointed member by the governor, and I'm also here as the executive director for the Arc of Oregon. As you probably already know, the Oregon Disabilities Commission is governor-appointed. We have 15 individuals that represent the full spectrum of disability organizations. More than half of the individuals on the commission are individuals with disabilities. And although I'm representing the Arc of Oregon and we represent developmental disabilities, the commission is cross-disability over all disabilities. I appreciate the opportunity to come and support this bill. I was here in February before you discussing guardianship and a task force with House Bill 2443 that really looked at kind of the same kind of issue for a task force, but for only developmental disabilities. At that time, we asked to pull that bill because of funding, and we are pursuing that with the Department of Human Services and other disability organizations to at least address those and work together. We're excited to hear about House Bill 2883 because this is pretty much the same thing, only it gives us a wider view of disabilities. We feel we can bring information to the table based on our program that's been a statewide-run program since the late 70s. We are a membership organization, and if you remember from my previous testimony, we became in existence because parents worried about what would happen to their children with intellectual and developmental disabilities once they were gone. These are the most vulnerable citizens in Oregon, whether they have intellectual disability, whether they're a senior with dementia. These are vulnerable citizens that need guardianship, and I appreciate the previous testimony discussing it was the last resort. It's a very serious issue and something that we all take very seriously. Currently, I gave you some stats last time, and I kept some of those in my testimony today. The issues, the numbers that are out there, the great need. Currently, our program serves over 105 individuals with very limited funding, and we're to the point where we can only take individuals that have the most horrific or abusive neglect issues. And that is certainly not what we are. Our mission is to do, but it is the reality of where we're currently at. We feel very excited to be able to work with a newly formed commission or task force, to look at guardianship issues, to learn from other disability populations or the senior population, as well as to bring our experience to the table and to work in collaboration, because we feel like that's going to get us the best means for the individuals that we serve. We really urge you to pass House Bill 2883, and we look forward to working with that task force. Thank you very much for your time, and if I can answer any questions, I'd be happy to.
Thank you so much.
Hello, Chair Representative Tomain and members of the House Human Services Committee. For the record, my name is Patty Little. I am a planner and a contract manager at the Senior and Disabled Services Office in Lane County. We are a division of Lane Council of Government, so we are not a county organization. We are also the Area Agency on Aging and Disability Services for Lane County. And I thank you for the opportunity to come and talk to you all in support of House Bill 2883 and the amendment. I would like to share thoughts with two different directions, one as a member of the Area Agency on Aging for Lane County, and the other as a past chair for three different guardianship studies that were conducted in Lane County. So you're going to see how long I've been working for this agency when you hear the year of the first study I conducted. I will not reiterate the need, because there is a great need, and folks have already explained the need and the fact that this is a program of last resort. But I would like to give a little background about the different studies. The first study that I conducted in Lane County was in 1994, and we are a very collaborative county. We had we were asked to bring together various disciplines and stakeholders to look and see if we could get a public guardianship program started in the county. We had folks from the Developmental Disability Agency, our own, mental health, both hospitals, the probate court, legal services, senior law, ARC of Lane County, private guardianship programs, and other members that were just members of the community at large. And our task was to gather research on state models and models around the country. And we have a little summary table that I could certainly share with you if you'd like that by email at a later date. We then were tasked with developing a model that we thought would work in Lane County, which we did, and then identifying the need based on that model. It was a three-tiered system that would allow some private funding to come into it. I was new to the planner position at the agency, I naively thought that this was going to pass because we had such support. And we went and we talked in front of the county commissioners, and at that time there was timber money, and there was money, and so I thought, this is going to work. We went in, and I was overwhelmed with the number of people there to testify. There were 500 people, not just for our program, but 500 people who had lost their program funds and were there to ask for it to be restored. So needless to say, the Board of County Commissioners did not fund a new program. They restored existing programs that had been cut previously. So I packed up all my research. I had boxes of research. And just kind of put it down to a learning experience. But I also did share my report with colleagues around the state, and many other counties got programs started that were not public guardianship programs but were private programs, and used my model research to start up those programs. I thought that was the end of it, but in 2000, Lane County, it was the Lane County Mental Health, asked me to resurrect the old study, bring the group back together, identify if there was still a need, and come up with a tweaking to the model. We did this. Of course, there was still the need identified. We presented again to the County Board of Commissioners, and it was not accepted. They were having funding problems. So then in 2006, while at a meeting that convened all of our stakeholders in Lane County that thought there was the need, I was asked again, would I chair a group, and would I develop a program model? I was specifically asked to develop a quasi-governmental model that took government and private entities. We did do this, but again, it wasn't funded because of budget concerns. And as I was sharing this information with my husband last night, who has done reporting in his life in the past, he's said that as he sees it, the current law's weakness is that it allows counties to set up these public guardianship programs, but it doesn't require them to. And so these programs become just one of many political priorities in the various counties. And it depends on when you're presenting whether or not it's accepted. So I would like to thank you for your time, and I would be available to answer any questions and or provide any of my past study material to you.
Thank you so much for your testimony.
Thanks.
Good morning, Chairwoman Tamay and committee members. Thank you for allowing me to appear before you this morning. I speak to you today in a personal capacity as the former director of the Utah State Office of Public Guardian, which I developed and led from 1999 to 2003 after the Utah legislature passed legislation establishing that office. The circumstances that we confronted in Utah were similar to those that are being described here in Oregon today. And so all of this has a rather eerie sense of deja vu for me. I'm also familiar with guardianship developments and practices in Nevada and California, having worked in those states in related capacities.
Could you give us your name again, please?
Yes, Travis Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Wall.
I strongly support and urge the passage of HB 2883. HB 2883 is needed because there's a significant unmet need for public guardianship services here in Oregon, as you've been hearing. It is likely that several thousand adults have diminished capacity to make decisions about themselves and their affairs as a result of age-related dementia, medical conditions, severe developmental disabilities, and serious and persistent mental illness, but have no responsible family member or friend willing and able to serve as a guardian. I base my estimate of the several thousand on a needs assessment survey that was done in 1997 in Utah, where we estimated that somewhere between 700 to 1,400 Utahns were in need of public guardianship services because of the absence of services in that state. Several years later, when we actually instituted the office and we surveyed guardianship developments in other states, as well as looked at the needs assessments that were done in a number of other jurisdictions and the experiences we had in providing services in Utah, we revised those numbers upwards. In about 2000, we estimated that the number was somewhere around 2,000. I might share with you that there are several useful tools out there that a number of other states have developed for assessing guardianship needs. So I think when we will get down to actually looking at this pretty carefully between Patty's work and this work from other states, I think we have the mechanisms and the tools to really quantify what the actual need is out there. Let me add that the absence of adequate public guardianship services places vulnerable and dependent adults at risk. The paucity of public guardianship services in Oregon exposes adults with no guardianship resources to abuse, neglect, and exploitation, including loss of property and serious irreparable harm, including death. As someone who has advocated for many years on behalf of both the elderly as well as people with disabilities, I find the situation really intolerable, and it's something that we really need to address with the utmost urgency. The lack of public guardianship services also raises troubling legal and ethical issues. In the absence of public guardianship services, healthcare professionals, service providers, and caretakers often act as de facto guardians by making medical, mental health, habilitative, and other decisions for individuals with diminished capacity under their care. However well-intentioned these professionals and providers may be, and irrespective of the necessity of the decisions involved, these professionals and providers are neither legally authorized nor trained to act as surrogate decision makers. Many decisions based on what in their professional or personal judgment is best for the incapacitated individual, not what the individual would want if the individual had decisional capacity. Making decisions on such a basis is probably unlawful, inconsistent with principles of self-determination and autonomy, and likely contrary to the standard of substitute decision-making, the primary basis by which professional guardians make decisions as surrogate decision-makers. I would add that development and implementation of public guardianship services need to be carried out thoughtfully, comprehensively, and systematically. The imposition of a guardianship of an adult is a serious and drastic step. While it may be necessary and of benefit to the individual subject to it, guardianship is restrictive and intrusive. It inevitably involves denial of fundamental civil liberties. Because of the gravity of guardianship, the provision of individual public guardianship services should be provided only when there is no less restrictive alternative and with the utmost care and thought. Comparable reflection, attention, and planning are in order on a larger scale when developing and refining a public guardianship program or system. The task force proposed by HB 2883, of course, addresses our need to look at a number of matters in developing recommendations for refining and expanding the availability of public guardianship services here in Oregon. In Utah, the Board of Public Guardianship Services and I undertook a similar process in writing an implementation plan for the Office of Public Guardian. After reviewing the available literature on guardianship, interviewing officials in states reported to have model programs, consulting with national guardianship experts, and obtaining input from key stakeholders, we produced a comprehensive document. The first half of this document reviews a whole series of matters that I could go into if we had more time. The second half of this plan details the office's new mission, its goals, objectives, structure, services, and funding. Let me back up, because I'm going to briefly mention, actually,
I'm going to ask
items.
You to wrap up, too, because
sure.
we need to.
Okay. Well, I guess let me just say that I'm very excited by the prospect of what might be accomplished through 2883, and, again, urge your adoption of it.
Great. Thank you so much. Your testimony is fascinating. Fascinating. All of the testimony has been fascinating. Any quick questions of anyone on this panel? Thank you all so much for coming. Did you?
Nope.
Oh,
I'm just
great.
Saying
Thank
too
you.
Good.
Yes, we were very good. Thank you so much. Very
Thank
thorough.
You. Was that your last? Yeah.
Yes.
Can I just comment?
Yes, absolutely. We have written testimony from Rick Bennett and Bill Olson also in our packets. Mm-hmm. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that the committee can hear from this morning's presentation the significant commitment there is on the part of many, many people to exploring and trying to develop something to fill a really gaping need out there. And it's a credit to some individuals that are in the room today that this is here. I was probably not the most supportive legislator they've ever talked to, as they kept telling me that this was absolutely essential, and I kept saying, this isn't the year, there's no money. And they then took that back and explored options, and I appreciate Bob Jundep and his organization's willingness to step in and help be part of this. They really do want to see this work done badly enough that they were willing to step back from state-funded task force and find an alternative way to accomplish the development of an idea that needs to be done. But I don't want to take away that at some point in time, we really do need to step up and address some issues, probably with public funding, that are not being addressed right now. But since this is not the year for it, I think that it's a real credit to the individuals who have worked this through to where they've come up with something we can do in the interim and bring back a plan for us that hopefully we'll be able to move on in the future. So I really thank them for their efforts.
And thank you, Representative Cowan. Thanks to all of you who came to testify today and all the work, obviously, hours and days and weeks and months of work on this. So thank you so much. So, Representative Cowan, this has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
I thought we'd taken care of that.
No, we don't have a subsequent referral.
I see it does still have one, but it has no fiscal impact.
We should, well, but we just got the amendments a few days ago, and so we should request the Speaker's office remove that subsequent referral.
Could we do that, please?
Yes.
Because that has been the effort to take that off.
Yes,
great. So I intend to bring this back for a work session, colleagues, and so we can move forward on this. So, again, thank you very much, and we hope that something will be happening this legislative year. Thank you. So I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2883 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3384. Representative Kotek, thank you for sticking around. I assume that's why you're here with that little girl. Mm-hmm. We're so glad you stayed. I'm sure she found it very boring, but she's been great.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. Nice to see you all again this morning. I think I should make this my regular Friday Friday gathering.
Before us today, thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing a hearing on House Bill 3384. It was introduced as a committee bill at my request because I really felt like this was a housekeeping bill, and so it made sense to make it a committee bill. This is regarding two changes to the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. And we do have several folks here to testify on the second half of the bill, so I'm going to be brief on the first section. This bill does two things. Section 1 would amend our statutes regarding public assistance for the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program to remove the requirement on a TANF applicant or recipient to assign any owed child support to the state for times when they are not receiving aid from the state, and thereby sending the child support for those periods to the families instead of the state. This was to reflect some changes that happened in TANF reauthorization back in 2006. It has come to my attention this morning that, because there's so much going on in this building, and we have different drafters for different things. House Bill 2275, which was passed through Judiciary and actually off the House floor and is on the Senate side, was amended to deal with the back child support issue that this bill was seeking to address. So I believe that it's very possible we do not need Section 1 at all because it's already been dealt with. And so what I'm doing, and I had this information from this morning, so I'm double-checking on that. I want to talk with the department a little more. The department, who you will hear from, had planned to testify with some of their concerns around Section 1, and I wanted to get back to them to talk about what the changes that Child Support Division had requested. How does that affect what we were trying to achieve with my bill? Do we need anything different to be done? So I would request that we come back, hopefully, to decide if we can just amend out Section 1 or if we do still indeed need to do some of the language. So I'm still working on that. Section 3, the second half of the bill, gets to an issue that many of us remember from last time talking about when we did a redesign of the TANF program in House Bill 2469 in 2007 session. We have an option here in the state for our TANF jobs program, now called Parents of Scholars, where 1% of the caseload, 1% of parents who are receiving TANF, can opt to complete a 2 or 4 year program as a job activity to get a degree. It's something that I think we're all very supportive of, but currently the statute caps it at 1% of the caseload. The Parents of Scholars option came into effect in October 1 of 2008. There was a large work group to work out all the details, but one of the things that became apparent was the statute, which had a 1% cap, was a little unclear what you would do if that number for the cap fluctuated depending on every year, because the statute reads January of every year, there's whatever 1% of the caseload it is in that point in time is the number of folks allowed to take advantage of this option. And so what this language seeks to do is clarify that if families are enrolled and for some reason the cap would drop, the families who are currently in a program taking this option would be grandfathered and continue until they finish the program or leave the TANF program. And that was apparently what the department has, how they have interpreted the statute, but this would clarify that in statute so there wouldn't be any discussion about what we do in the case when the caseload fluctuates and we have people in the program. We currently have, I think we're at full participation in the Parents of Scholars program. So this is just, again, a housekeeping issue to make sure we're clear what we're doing there. But there are a couple families here today who want to talk about their participation in the Parents of Scholars program, which I'm really pleased they're here. And with that, I think I will just one more thing. If hopefully we can, when we come back with amendments, remove the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. I'm not sure it's needed, but we'll look into that as well. So
great.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Kotek. Any quick questions of Representative Kotek? All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So do we have people signed up?
Great.
Thank you. Okay. Vic Todd? Vic, I'm going to ask you to wait a minute. Is that okay with you? And we'll have some of the people who have the people. Julie Benetel, is that right? Anna Winston and, Sahua? Sabina. Hi, Sabina.
Good.
Come on up.
Great. I just put that baby to sleep in 2 minutes.
Go ahead.
Maybe.
Oh, my goodness. Good job. Go ahead. Anybody?
Hello.
Hi.
Hello, everybody. I'm here today to talk about the Parents of Scholars program and what it's done for me. It's a very supportive encouraging program. It gives me the courage to be able to go out and pursue.
Oh, give us your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. Julie Benetti. And as I was saying, it gives me the courage because I have the support to go out and get a education. I have overcome quite a few barriers, one being that I am in recovery and have been for about 4 years. When I was 19, I tried to go to school and went to BCTI, which I'm now in a class action lawsuit against because their practices were not they weren't giving us the right kind of education. They were pretty much fraudulently in business. Business Computer Training Institute. So in turn, I had been in default on my student loans for a number of years and was able to finally get it to where I could get student loans. But now I have 3 kids. And so going to school with even just student loans would have proven to be very difficult. Fortunately, I am TANF eligible now, and so I am eligible for the Parents of Scholars program. And I am in the criminal justice program at PCC, Cascade Campus. I hopefully will be working in the courts at some capacity or maybe even in corrections or maybe alcohol and drug counseling. I don't know yet. I feel so empowered to be able to go to school, and I have so much courage, and I have so many new opportunities open to me now that I have I've only been in it for 2 years, or almost 2 years, and I have so many more opportunities. I feel like I'm so much more resourceful. I was resourceful when I didn't have an education, but it wasn't the right type of resourceful. Now I can get, have a life. And I have a 17-year-old son who is competing with me for grades because I get straight A's, and he gets straight A's now, and I'm very proud of him. And I have the courage to succeed and do good in life. Without Parents of Scholars, my only hope would have been to try to raise 3 kids and myself on minimum wage. I got into Parents of Scholars through Sabina Riggi. Told me about the VT. Well, I was working at, I was doing community service at the Chet Center for Family Success, and they hired me, and then I went on to work with Sabina at Peninsula Children's Center, and she told me about VT, and I started, and I had to get my credits up to where I could do DCI, and then DCI turned into Parents of Scholars. And so I've been very lucky to know the right people to be able to get into Parents of Scholars. I really think that it's a great opportunity, and if someday if it could be opened up to more people, that would be very awesome. Because I know that for a fact that I have hope now, and I know that it would give other people hope to get an education. So,
thank you so much.
Thank you.
Congratulations. Thank you.
May I ask her a question? Did you mean your son is 7?
17.
I can't believe
no.
You were a high school.
I have
school.
A 7-year-old son, too.
Oh, my God.
And a 17-year-old son.
You look very young.
And they're all doing wonderful, and they love to see me going to school. And it helps them to know that, I tell them, I could have done this when I was younger, and so you need to do it now. And they all are doing so wonderful, and it helps to see me going to school. I really know that it helps them want to do good, to see me doing good. So, thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, I'm Anna Winston, and I kind of wrote it out because I get kind of stuttery and bubbly and all that stuff when I talk, but I'm getting better at it. So, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I wanted to be able to give you some of my history. I'd like to start by saying that I grew up in poverty with a single mother that was disabled and a deadbeat father. So my mother struggled to raise us utilizing the welfare system before it was called TANF. So I quickly began being involved with drugs and gangs, and I was incarcerated for serious offenses by the time I was at the age of 9.
Soon I was in prison and a single mother myself, and I too utilized the welfare system, attending the jobs program. With an extensive prison record and a child, I had a hard time gaining employment, and I was hired by an agency that worked with multilingual persons because I do speak two other languages besides English. I speak Vietnamese and Spanish, so I quickly moved up in that agency, but they went out of business, and I found myself back on TANF attending the jobs program and feeling a little hopeless because of the prison record. I fell into addiction that took my life through a really bad ordeal, and it included like dangerous relationships, things like that, and I didn't have support to help me get where I wanted to be. After attending treatment at LifeWorks Northwest and getting custody of my child back from DHS, I decided that I needed to move forward in a different direction with my life, and that I wanted to not only be self-sufficient, but to be that independent woman that I know I am. And being that my life has had the ups and downs that it did, I knew that I could get through and survive anything, so I researched and reached out to several resources and community, and Sabina Rigi got me started on my path to setting and obtaining my goals. Working with her and Linda Wyman and Sean Mooney through, they work for AFS, we decided that I could be on the VT program and start school. And I started school fall 2 years ago. I was actually in Mr. Denver's class. Mm-hmm. I got an A. but I actually am currently pursuing an associate's in alcohol and drug counseling. I'm in my second year, and I will be receiving my degree by fall of 2010. By being in the PASS program, I am able to transfer to PSU that fall and begin working towards my bachelor's in social work. My goal and career of choice is to become an alternative sentencing advocate at the Public Defender's Office to work towards assessing and referring offenders to different community programs and resources that will help them regain their structure in the community and life as far as drugs and addiction go, and you know, with either probation or suspended prison sentences instead of just sending them to prison. Through PASS, I will be able to obtain my long-term goals and be of service to my community the way they were of service to me. I will be self-sufficient within 4 years of employment, that is long-term, instead of joining the revolving door of the jobs program and the welfare system. This will also be beneficial to my child, who will study hard in school and earn the necessary degrees for her career of choice because she sees my determination and my study ethics to fulfill my educational and employment goals. By being able to utilize my community resources, this ex-gang member, ex-drug dealer, and ex-drug addict and survivor of domestic violence is now capable of resuming her life's journey and becoming a self-sufficient single mother and empowered as a college student with a positive future. Without the support and potential for a wonderful future, only God knows where I would be now.
Thank you so much for coming to tell us your story. Sabina. Nice accolade.
Thank you. Hello, my name's Sabina Riggi. Although I haven't had the opportunity to experience Parents of Scholars, I've kind of been out there pushing people through as quick and kind of behind the scenes, if you will, to help navigate and get them into the right career path. We all know that, you know, without post-secondary education, you kind of end up with your family, and as your family grows, we kind of end up in a stuck situation. Along with these two young ladies, I've been privileged to be able to work with a number of folks in the community to help them navigate through DHS as it relates to DCI, Parents of Scholars, VT. And it's been very empowering for me. I know that through education, lady parents have been able to break the cycle that they've been kind of stuck on through generations. I've taken the parent, you know, this whole journey of education and TANDF through about four employers, and as well as when I started advocating as a volunteer advocate with the Oregon Food Bank many years ago. It's just real empowering for me to see people, as I'm a part-time student myself at PSU, and work full-time and do foster care. So it keeps me rather busy, but for me, even this past term, someone that I was able to navigate about 4 years ago through DCI and now Parents of Scholars showed up in one of my social work classes. So that was real uplifting to me to see them continue to follow on. I can't speak highly enough about Parents of Scholars and what it's done. The places that I've seen, you know, Julie and I worked close together. There was, when she came to me, it was, they were denying her because once she didn't have enough credits to go into the DCI. So in working with Julie, it was about getting her in a place where she could be accepted and continue on. I was working at Peninsula Children's Center, and she came to me through, like she said, Center for Family Success, but then started working with me as an assistant so I could allow her to take those credits at the community college to gain those credits and continue on to her degree that she's been in. How long have you been? She's going on 2 years now. So just, you know, kind of navigating is something that's important, as well as retaining. A lot of folks get lost in the college system. As we all know, it's a whole different ball of wax going from, you know, even a high school to a community college, and especially if you've started, went back to school in your later years. It's something that's very intimidating and very scary. I've continued to make myself available throughout the years for folks when they run into those bumps in the road. And consequently, it ends up keeping them on track. So I'm very happy for that, and I'm very proud of Parents of Scholars.
Good. Thank you so much. Thank you. Any questions of these? Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have to make a comment. What a shock it was, and a pleasant one, to see Anna here this morning, and her daughter, whom I remember from many conferences in my office. She never slept during those. I will say she's no less cute than she was then. So I see you're still giving her cute pills every morning. Anna is just a real success story. I think, you know, you heard it from her. I got to have her first term in school, and we got to know each other. I got to know her story quite well. And, you know, as often happens when students first come back to school, there's a lot of, you know, it's they're taking a chance, right? And there was a lot of insecurity, and Anna was just, you know, committed to working really hard because she kept talking about her daughter and how she was going to turn her life around, not just for herself, but for her daughter and for other people that she could help. And I can't tell you what that was. When it came to the end of that term, I hadn't thought about this for quite a while, and I was able to give Anna an A, which wasn't where it looked like it was going to go at the very beginning.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting down looking, my gosh, she's getting an A in this course. I was so proud. And it's of course great to see that my investment in you and giving you an A has paid off.
Yeah, thank you.
Takes a village.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Timbrough. Any further questions? Oh, Representative Boone.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And what a nice way to end our week with some good news. This is great to hear. Congratulations to both of you and to Sabina for all your help.
You.
I have one question. What is DCI?
Degree Completion Incentive was the pilot project, or program rather, that felt that Parents of Scholars became solid from. When this whole, you know, initiative came about as far as school and TANF or DHS allowing folks to go to school, it was a cap of 100 folks, parents, that were able to, you know, continue their education. However, they had to be in their last 12, within their last 12 to 24 months of receiving their degree, and they would they could access 12 months of services. So it a little bit limiting. However, it took, just to give you an idea, then that was statewide. So it took almost the 3 years, two and a half, almost 3 years it was in existence. It took almost that time to get to even get a waiting list. By the time Parents of Scholars came into effect, there were three people on the waiting list. So, which is kind of, you know, a program as fantastic as that, whether it was, you know, readiness or people, you know, as far as people getting denied because they weren't to that mark, is some questions that I have brought up and been able to work through going into Parents of Scholars. So, yeah, DCI is just a pre piece of Parents of Scholars.
Thank you. Thank you. Vic, I know we still want to hear from you, but a quick question from Representative Van Orman, then we'll get Vic Todd.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. Mine may be passed, but I'm, as usual, struggling with the complexity of the Department of Human Services. And
so do you want to talk with Vic? Because Vic will be coming up. Is the question for him?
It probably is, yes.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, and we're proud to hear of your success.
I would love to see it expand.
So would we all. And as Representative Boone said, it is great to have this on Friday when it's been a tough week. Thank you so much for coming to tell your stories. Vic, sorry that you've had to wait so long to speak, but we're glad you're here. Did you have any closing words?
I was just going to say, I hope I get Benny's for bringing happy stories.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
I hope that helps.
Jelly beans is it.
Okay, Vic. Thank you for staying.
Thank you. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I did have written testimony, but I'd like to defer that and just make a couple of comments.
Sure.
Since we're going to work through some of that language, if that's okay.
Sure.
The Parents of Scholars, that has been a great addition to this program, and so I was happy to hear some of that discussion also, because I think it is another component that helps address a particular portion of the TANF population that can benefit from it. So just wanted to make that comment. So we support what is now Section 3 in the proposed bill, which relates to the PASS clarification. And as Representative Kotek said, we did, in our administrative rule, interpret it that way, that we would not penalize someone ultimately as a result of a caseload change, that we would want them to complete what it is they undertook. So with that, I will stop. I'm taking questions.
That was certainly brief. Thank you. Representative Van Orman, do you have a question?
Yes,
for
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. It's about ERDC and TANF. And I'm trying to sort out, this may be, in fact, because it's from a different funding source, but my understanding in Oregon that employment-related daycare clients are not eligible for the daycare if they're going to school. And so my assumption was that it's, what's the difference between that and what we're talking about here today?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, Representative Van Orman, actually the employment-related daycare is for families who are employed. Mm-hmm. And so if a person is on TANF, say, for example, and in the PASS program, then their child care costs are covered through the jobs program. And so the difference between those is that if they are on employment-related daycare, there's a copay, whereas when they are on TANF in the jobs program, there is no copay.
Follow-up. So then how do we determine which program they go to? In other words, what makes them go to ERDC or what makes them go to your Parents of Scholars.
Chair Tomei, Representative Van Orman, what ultimately determines it is the income levels. And so there's an income thresholds for the TANF program, And once a person becomes ineligible due to employment, there's an income threshold related to the employment-related daycare that ends at 185% of the poverty level.
For ERDC?
For ERDC.
Okay. Okay. So, follow-up?
Oh, follow-up?
So then the TANF would be the lowest of the lower, I mean lower than ERDC, right?
Chair Tomei, Representative Van Orman, that's correct. Currently the eligibility threshold is about 43% of the federal poverty level for TANF. It's not tied to the federal poverty level, but that's how it approximates in terms of that income threshold.
Thank you. I think I understand. Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Maurer.
Yeah, I am totally supportive of Section 2. So this comment is not because I don't support the change, but the plain language of the current law is pretty clear. I mean, I don't know how you get to the point where you can interpret this law any differently than it says, you know, based percent based on January 1st numbers. So I get my only question, comment, maybe a rebuke is I don't know how you interpret it any other way than the plain language of the law. And I think it was wrong. That was not our intent at the point at that time, and I support the change, but I just caution in liberal interpretations of the plain language of the law.
If you have a response, sure.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, I think that in working through this, we interpreted that the intent was to keep, you know, once people were in the program, to keep them in that, in what their plan had been. And so that was how we arrived at that.
Okay.
I'll stop because I don't want to be political.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you so much, Vic.
Thank you.
Representative Kotick, did you have any closing words before we close this hearing?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the indulgence. Representative Kotick, again, I'm a huge fan of Parents and Scholars. We don't create the right incentives in some of our programs. I would love to see the cap higher than 1%. I don't know how we get that. Get there in anytime soon with our financial situation. But I just wanted to say that given some of the reductions that we're facing possibly in the TANF program, we've built a really strong program, and I think we should just be aware that reductions that we're currently contemplating could have devastating effects on even the ability of the parents you heard from to be successful. So, but Parents of Scholars is a success, and I think we should all be proud of it, and it is a fabulous way to end the week. Thank you.
Then Representative Deborah Kafori and I worked on this bill years ago.
2001, ma'am.
Yes, it was 2001, right. So wow. We worked really hard, and believe me, it was an uphill battle, and it is so wonderful to see it so successful. Thank you for bringing these stories to us today. Anything further for the good of the order? I will close.
May I just add something?
Sure.
I would like to say that, above all, it's about the children. That if we get the parents on a path of recovery or achievement or improving their life, the children benefit greatly.
Absolutely, Representative. Thank you for pointing that out. Thank you. I will close the public hearing on, 3384, and close the House Committee on Human Services. I love this committee.